It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4-1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Today, I have the unhappy task of informing you that according to every metric of significance, Islamic extremism has grown over the last year, whether it be the scale and scope of ISIS and its associated movements, the number of violent Islamist groups, the territory which these groups control, the number of terrorist attacks these groups perpetrate, the massive numbers and suffering of refugees and displaced persons due to these Islamist groups, that's approximately 15 million people, the amount of kidnapping and rape of women and children by these groups, the numbers of casualties they inflict, their broad expansion and use of the internet, which is very serious, or just their sheer barbarism that we've witnessed. I can draw no other conclusion than to say that the threat of Islamic extremism has reached an unacceptable level and that it is growing.
That's the voice of Lieutenant General Michael Flynn. That was February the 13th of 2015. It was actually a very dramatic moment because it was counter to the narrative of the Obama administration. At the time, General Flynn was the director of the Defense Intelligence Agency and the senior military intelligence officer in the Department of Defense. And after that, he was removed in some form or fashion. We're not sure why, how, and we're going to ask that question because he joins us this morning. Lieutenant General Flynn, thank you so much for making time for us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Sandy. Real honor. Honor to join my friend Michael Adine. I know who will be on a little bit later.
Yes, absolutely. I should say, in fact, I will say that along with Michael Adine, who we'll introduce him shortly, you've written a new book called The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies. It's just out, and we're going to talk about that book. But just some personal questions for you first. You say, actually, in the border of the book, you say of your words, terminated from government service. You were terminated, sir? I mean, I don't remember hearing that. What happened?
Yeah, I mean, I basically was called into an office call inside the Pentagon, and I was told you're going to be departing from your job a year early. And I had a very short conversation with the two gentlemen in the room with me, and I asked them if my leadership was in question, and they said absolutely not. You know, it's essentially for other reasons, and I knew then and there what the reasons were. It's because of some of the things that I had been saying, particularly about radical Islamism and the rise of it, as we have seen it, you know, even up until today, we're still seeing some of the problems that we're facing around the world. So it's a dangerous enemy, and our current administration refuses to accept that.
You know, the thing that puzzles all of us, you know, many of us who are watching, have our finger on the pulse, for better or for worse, is it's mystifying, given the facts, why more military leaders are not countering this administration. Can you explain that?
Well, I think military leaders and retired military leaders are two different things. So, I mean, obviously people inside the military have to, you know, they continue to respect the Constitution and their, you know, their loyalty to that and to our commander-in-chief, you know, for good or bad. But retired military, I agree. I mean, I think that those of us that have retired that have enormous experience and frankly, leadership development over many years. I think that, you know, some are just, you know, they don't want to. They want to stay out of it. And it's just a decision, a conscious decision that I made that I could not see the direction that our country was taking without standing up and saying something about it. I mean, and this was well before I got involved in any support to, you know, the current Republican nominee, Donald Trump. I mean, I was adamant that our country's going in the wrong direction. We're facing an enemy that is vicious and has declared war on us.
I'm sure that if you were to outline, and maybe you have, all the things that led up to your testimony to the boiling point where you said, I'm speaking out. Do you remember that incident where everything changed and you said, I've had it. I have to say something. I can't let this stand. Do you remember what that was?
Well, I mean, it was going on for a number of years while I was still serving and trying to fight inside the system to get people to recognize that we're not just facing, an enemy on the battlefield, on the physical battlefield. We're actually facing a very powerful, very determined ideology that is dangerous to our way of life and is anti to our way of life and actually sees our way of life as something that is that should not exist anymore. So their ability to grow and to expand and to get inside of the bloodstream of our own system, whether it's into Europe or whether it's through the United, right here in our homeland, is a very real problem, and it's happening every day around us. And I see it more and more. The more I get around the country and talk to people in cities and towns around the country, I'm getting the same feedback, and people are genuinely concerned about it and scared in some cases.
General Flynn, we covered here on this show, because we have so many national security friends here in Washington who are alert and aware of the subversion of our training manuals, the scrubbing of certain words. And we talked about that a great deal. So here you are, you're sitting in a position of authority, you're the head of defense intelligence, for heaven's sake. What were your thoughts when these things were taking place?
Well, I mean, when you cannot clearly define your enemy, that's probably one of the biggest mistakes a military organization can make, not to mention a country and a commander-in-chief. If you cannot clearly identify, define who it is that you're up against, then there's no way that you're going to be able to develop any sort of coherent strategy to defeat it. And, I mean, we did it against the Nazis. We did it against the Soviet Union and the communists, it took time in both cases, and it took enormous sacrifice. And now we know that we are now facing another ism in the case of radical Islamism, and our president and our administration doesn't even want us to use that phrase. And they've excised it from, like you say, in training manuals and other things. I mean, you just can't use it. The president even says, what difference does it make what you call somebody? Well, it makes all the difference in the world, Mr. President. And that's also helps all of us understand what is it about this ideology that is so anti-U.S. and anti our way of life.
You're talking to a lot of military people. We have a lot of military listeners, bases around the country, mm-hmm. Who listen to American Family Radio, listen to this show in the morning, and I often think of them when the news breaks. I think of them all the time. I hear from them, and as a former leader of those men and women, what would you say to them serving during these uncertain times with really, I think I could, I'm not going to argue it, I'll just say it flat out, terrible leadership. Disgraceful leadership, even in the military and in executive branch. What would you say to encourage them? How should they think and how should they feel about what they're doing?
Yeah, so in a little bit. I mean, my father was World War II in Korea, and a retired sergeant first class from the Army. And I grew up with nine brothers and sisters. And if there's one thing in my house that was going to occur, was you were going to be honest with our parents. So I think whether you're a private in the military or a seaman, or you're a lieutenant or you're a general, what we should demand out of our leaders is honesty. And that means, and even family members, spouses who are being asked to volunteer time and sacrifice their own schedules and their own things to be able to help around in military bases. I mean, there's so much goodness to our military and what our military is asked to do, and especially our families. And so the only thing I would expect is I would expect blunt honesty and the truth from our leaders, and not any sugarcoating, no political correctness, and demand it. I actually think that the demand up needs to always put the pressure on those, leaders, commanders, what have you, to tell the truth. If we're not winning something, we ought to say it. If we're facing an enemy that we're being told, hey, this is not, you can't use those words, that's baloney. I mean, we ought to be honest with each other. I mean, come on. Everybody knows what it is that we're facing. It's very clear. It's right in our faces. And, you know, I mean, these guys that are around this country that are killing people and also overseas that are killing people in the name of some ideology that that is so anti-U.S. and anti our values, we should not be afraid. People in our country, people in our military should not fear what our country was built upon, which is a set of Judeo-Christian principles and values. And we shouldn't accept some of these other things. I just would say that honesty and truth and demanding that sort of a bottom up, I would push on our system because, frankly, that they can handle it. If there's any component of our U.S. citizenry that can handle the tough truth, and that's our people, that's the men and women and the families inside the military who sacrificed so much.
General Flynn, you already said, before I even ask you, you said that you are on the Trump defense team or advisory team. Mm-hmm. And so you've obviously decided to support him. You've thrown your name in the ring with his. And you know how controversial that is. I mean, the intelligentsia here in Washington, it's like you have cooties if you dare say you support Donald Trump. You see what's happening in the media, yeah. How he's imploding. I'd love to know why is it that you tell us why you support him so strongly? What is it about him that makes you believe he's going to be a better commander in chief?
Yeah, let's be honest here, okay? I mean, again, you know, We're talking about, you know, two imperfect candidates, but one who is actually a criminal and has demonstrated criminal behavior and certainly has acted in a criminal way with the disclosure of highly sensitive, highly classified information in Hillary Clinton, and a guy who doesn't always say, you know, the perfect politically correct thing, and probably jumps on issues that he shouldn't jump on. So I'm gonna be very blunt with you. So I mean, but what has Donald Trump done? Donald Trump has put a stake in the heart of political correctness in this country, which I think is needed right now. People are, as I've said, people are genuinely scared in some cases and certainly concerned in others. And he's also touched or put his finger on a deeply underappreciated segment of the United States of America, you know, people between Washington, D.C. and Hollywood, who just feel like their government has left them behind and is no longer being there to help them be safe, help them thrive and find jobs and all those kinds of things. So Donald Trump has put his finger on that large, large segment of the American population. And that's why, I've met him a few times. I've talked with him. I like his style. I like his bluntness. I like his honesty. And he's actually has a big heart. I mean, the guy cares deeply about people and he wants to do what's best for this country. All this nonsense that you hear about, well, Trump's doing this for Trump. He could, he's not doing this for Donald Trump. He's got a lot of other things that he could get involved in. He saw, as many of us in this country, saw the country going in the wrong direction, and he decided, you know what, I'm going to jump into the arena and get involved and try to help the country. You know, and it's all these people that are throwing stones, particularly those many in the media that throw stones at him and twist everything he says. You know what? And especially others who are out there from the bleachers throwing things at them, get in the arena, join. You know, if you got a problem with the way, you know, politics is going, then jump in and do what he's doing. He's not a politician. He's a guy who cares deeply about this country. And that's why I like what I see in him.
We only have a minute left before we take a break and start actually talking about your new book. But I want to ask you if a new commander in chief could actually, literally, we have less than a minute, could actually clean out the Pentagon, and maybe I shouldn't put it that way, could actually turn things around in terms of military leadership and get this ship set in the right direction. I guess a short answer, yes or no, could they do it?
I mean, yes, they can, and this is about winning and a winning attitude and developing a culture that wants to win, knows they can win, and gets out there and wins. That's what this is really all about. That's
all right.
What this election's about.
All right. My guest is Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, and his new book is The Field of Fight. And he wrote it with our next guest, Michael Ledeen, who joins us next. And we're going to talk about how we can win this fight. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Dexcom cooked the books, shaded the evidence, and the Obama administration, in turn, manipulated the public. Those were the explosive initial findings of a Congressional Task Force report investigating allegations that U.S. Central Command painted a rosier picture of its progress in the war against ISIS than was warranted by the facts on the ground. The report reviewed assessments of the air campaign in Iraq and Syria beginning in 2014 and seemed to substantiate claims by whistleblowers that they were told to water down ISIS and al-Qaeda threats. The report said CENTCOM proffered comments on draft intelligence products produced outside the command. Products were consistently more optimistic regarding the conduct of U.S. military action than that of the senior analysts. CENTCOM press releases, public statements, and congressional testimonies were also significantly more positive than actual events.
The president called ISIS the JV. He said that al-Qaeda was on the run, and senior intelligence leaders were molding intelligence to fit that storyline.
The report showed no direct evidence of White House influence in CENTCOM's assessments, but one of President Obama's defense secretaries told Fox News he saw signs that staff members were following the president's lead.
Too often, people are kind of worried or second-guessing where the president wants to go, and they try to then shade their views to basically please the president.
And one expert says flawed readouts may have put lives at risk.
The president of the United States has had a tendency to minimize the threat from our adversaries and to exaggerate the progress that we have made against them.
All right, well, that's at least an abbreviated report from Kevin Cork of Fox News, and this is Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk, and I think that clip sort of illustrates what our guest, Lieutenant General Michael Flynn, was talking about, the truth. And that's why he spoke out, even when he was an active commander of the Defense Intelligence Agency, setting the record straight at a congressional hearing, and that's really what ended his career in the military. He left it, though, to make the most of everything that he's doing. He's written a book called How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies in a new book called The Field of Fight. He's with us still. Also, Michael Adeen joins us. Michael is becoming a familiar person to all of you. He's one of the leading experts in this country on the Middle East, on Iran especially. He's the author of more than 35 books. Most recently, The Accomplice to Evil, and lots of other things. He is a freedom scholar at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He was a special advisor to the Secretary of State. And on we could go. He knows what he's talking about, and that's Michael Adeen. Good morning, Michael, and welcome.
Hi, Sandy. Hi, it's General.
All right, Now I've got two Michaels. This is going to be challenging to distinguish between you guys. Hey, why in the world did you, both of you are experts, obviously, in very different ways. So why did you choose to combine your efforts in this book? And I guess more explicitly, how does your expertise complement each other's? And Michael Adeen, we'll ask you that question first.
Well, General Flynn asked me very kindly if I'd be willing to work with him on such a book. And I was thrilled and said, of course, hell yes.
Lieutenant General, why did you ask Michael?
Well, I knew Michael, he's a friend of mine, and I knew what his background was and his, certainly his capabilities, and I've enjoyed reading much of what he's been writing about for years. And I felt like this experience, the personal experiences that I've had certainly over the last 10 years, if not the last, you know, 3.5 decades of my life and even longer into my own growing up, were an important part of a story that needed to be told. And with Michael's expertise and knowledge in the region and with history, I think we were able to combine to put together a really excellent read. And obviously it's hit all the bestseller lists here almost immediately. So we're really happy about where this message has gotten and the exposure that it is getting.
All right, let's get right to it, because Michael Adeen, Iran is really central to this fight, right? Iran is really kind of the heart of all of this.
Yeah, well, the State Department says so. Even the president says so. The world's leading sponsor of terrorism, and they've been killing Americans ever since the revolution of 1979.
Mike, Lieutenant General Flynn, when you were active duty, certainly you traced Iran's hand to so much of the grief that happened to America. Besides what Michael Adeen just said, give us the illustrations of why Iran, in your mind, is so central to this problem.
Well, I mean, a lot of people don't realize it, but Iran's connection to Al Qaeda is very, it runs deep, and it's very, it has a long history. It goes even before 9/11. So people think that this is just a Shia versus Sunni fight. And actually, you know, it's the old enemy of my enemy is my friend. And one of the things that I think that we highlight in the book are some of the relationships that exist between Iran, which is still the leading state sponsor of terrorism as designated by our State Department, and Al Qaeda, which is an organization that still is alive and well and kicking today. We also have the Islamic State, but we have this ideology, this broader radical Islamist ideology, and Iran is at the very heart of it.
Michael Ledeen, we're going to talk about this with you in the last segment, but and Michael Flynn alluded to this, there is not, okay, they're different in detail, but the whole notion of fighting radical Islam is not that different from fighting communism, is it? Could it be? I mean?
No, it isn't. It's because radical Islam is another totalitarian, anti-American movement that seeks to rule the world. So it's very similar. And the leaders of radical Islamic movements all want the essence of single-party dictatorships, absolute control over minds, bodies, souls of their people, and so forth. So it's the same thing all over again. It's Yogi Berra.
Yeah, and let me jump in, Sandy, because sure. I think this is a really important point, and we highlight this in the book. We talk really about discrediting the ideology much as we've discredited the ideology of communism. And we lay out some really good ideas about how to go about doing that. But yet still, our administration does not allow us to even describe it or define this enemy for what it is. So in order to be able to, you know, to win this war, one of the big components is to be able to discredit the ideology. And that's really what you're asking about and what Michael's describing.
Let me ask you both. Of course, this is the elephant in the room. I could fill in the blanks, and I don't know how much of the blanks you fill in your book, but this administration dances with radical Islam all the time. Every decision comes down to their advantage. It's amazing. And so, Michael Flynn, when you were serving, when did that sort of hit you, that understanding and knowledge? And I can't imagine, that is our enemy. You say in the book it's a world war. How does one deal with the knowledge that the administration is doing everything policy-wise to advance that cause, and yet the military's fighting it?
Yeah, it's funny, but all you have to do is read what the enemy posts and what the enemy states in their own plans and their magazines and their, you know, in the world of social media. I mean, everything that they've said, they've actually done. They've actually taken action on what they say. So when they say something, we should take them very seriously about what they're going to do. The second thing is the infiltration through various groups inside of this country is very real. And I won't go into any detail, but there's an act called the American Laws for America,
American
Courts Act, ALAC. And people ought to go look that up because it's a real eye-opener when you begin to think about how these groups are influencing at the local, city, and to a degree, some levels at the state level, on how to impose Sharia law into our own country. So it's a real serious issue, and people need to pay attention to it.
Michael Ledeen, you know, Donald Trump has been criticized for saying that Obama and Hillary Clinton created ISIS. I'd like your perspective on that. Is that crazy talk, or is there some reason to think that?
Well, they certainly did things that made the emergence of ISIS more likely and easier. After we defeated al-Qaeda in Iraq, instead of clinching the deal and working with the Iraqis to make sure that that country was secure and stable and moving forward toward a freer society, we, that is, say, first Bush, then Obama and Clinton, ran away. We packed up and moved out of Iraq and left the field open, and the Iranians moved right back in. The Iranians had always supported Zarqawi And ISIS is simply a later stage of al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is what we were fighting all along.
Well, the way I would put it, Sandy, if you don't mind, the way I would put it is, in warfare, when you have victory, which is essentially what we had between 2009 and 2011, we achieved victory over al-Qaeda in Iraq and settled the problem down. But in warfare, when you achieve victory, you must be prepared to sustain that victory. And for purely political reasons, Barack Obama decided not to, and he pulled the plug in 2011, which led to this rapid rise of now what we call the Islamic State.
Lieutenant General Flynn, one of the premises, the important premise of your book is that you actually say that we can win this global war against radical Islam, and you say it is war. It's a global war. It's a world war. Without reading, you know, we can't read the book in two minutes, but really, honestly, you really believe that, and if so, how in the world?
Yeah, I do believe it, and I believe it, in every fiber of my body. I mean, there's no enemy that's unbeatable, and we should not look at this and say, oh, we're just going to always have to put up with this problem. No, we don't. We have to deal with this, and in the book, we do lay it out. In fact, there's a chapter titled How to Win. And we lay out, you know, the sort of the strategic components of a winning strategy. And to me, we just have to decide that that's what we want to do. And right now, we have a leader in the White House that can't even, he doesn't even want to talk about winning. He doesn't even want to talk about who this enemy is. He wants to avoid it and has, and it's hurt us.
You know, we keep hearing these reports. I'm really curious to know your answer about this one. Just last week, two leaders of ISIS killed in a drone strike. Oh, what does that mean, and how effective is that?
Yeah, if you're asking me, Sandy, it's one of those things that has a blip on the screen in the big media world, and it makes, you know, it might make the mainstream media feel good because they can report that there's something going on in this war against this enemy, but it's irrelevant. I mean, in the bigger scheme of things, and this administration will continue, as Hillary Clinton is. They'll continue to talk about, you know, the death of bin Laden as though it was some, you know, turning point, some inflection point against and is causing us to win. Actually, it's created more problems. So it is a component, but it is not a winning strategy. And that's what this administration has done, is they've used that, what you just described, as sort of their overall strategy instead of bringing other capabilities and elements together. And this is really the whole idea about discrediting, you know, back to discrediting of the ideology. We've got to face up to it. This ideology is so opposed to our way of life, and we're kidding ourselves to think that it's otherwise.
Michael Ledeen, you're an academic, you're a professor, and you write and you think, and certainly you've had hands-on jobs too, but you're not a military man. So as you were working on this book with General Flynn, did you going into this think that ISIS and this whole business of Islamic radical Islam is a battle that could be won? Did you believe that?
Well, sure. We want it every time we have taken them on the battlefield, we have won. And even the Arab world, we cite at considerable length a study of the Muslim world, as Obama likes to call it, really the Arab world. And it's a total failure. My favorite factoid of all the research that we did for Field of Fight is that more books have been translated in the last year into Spanish than have been translated into Arabic in the last 1,000 years.
Oh, my gosh.
So we're dealing with a level of ignorance and lack of knowledge that's really spectacular. And no wonder they fail. No wonder they make a mess of everything.
Michael Flynn, you had something you wanted to say.
Well, I'm just saying, you know, that data point that Michael Ledeen just stated, think about that. I use that when I talk to different groups because it's stunning what that means to an entire segment of the population of the world when they're only worried about what is said in one book. And what is in that book and what that book tells them to do. And, you know, I mean, that's part of what we're facing is this a large component of the world. So it's about 1.7 billion people. And that's why we also do talk about in the book the big speech, very intellectually courageous speech by President El-Sisi in President of Egypt, when he made the speech about, you know, what should we expect from Islam? What should we expect from the Muslim world? Should we expect the 1.7 billion Muslims to kill the other 7 billion people on the planet? It is almost verbatim what he said. And he said, absolutely not. We need a revolution in this ideology. And he called for it, but we didn't embrace it. And I think we should have embraced it at that point.
Well, Lieutenant General Flynn, listen, we are so grateful for your service to this country. And I think you really showed us the kind of man you are when you stood up and said something so counter to the administration and paid for it with your job. And you're still fighting. And so we just appreciate it so much. I can't tell you. The book is called The Field of Fight, How We Can Win the Global War Against Radical Islam and Its Allies, co-authored by Michael Ladeen, who's joining. He's staying with us, but Michael Flynn, we're going to say goodbye to you, and we wish you well and safety and Godspeed.
Thank you, Sandy, and good talking to you, Michael. We'll see you soon.
All right. This is Sandy Rios coming back with Michael Ladeen to finish this discussion on AFR Talk.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
Well, it turns out the Iranian nuclear deal may have already cost a life. Tehran announcing it executed a prominent nuclear scientist who had apparently defected to the United States in 2009, only to return home 1 year later. He was hanged. The Iran regime says he, quote, provided the enemy, that's us, with vital information on the program. He was 40-year-old Shamran Amiri. U.S. officials told the AP he was paid $5 million for information on the nuclear program, only returned home claiming he was kidnapped by the U.S. government. But the opposition says he went home because the Iranian regime threatened his family. Why was he put to death? And what does that mean? There are emails that the Associated Press has to Mrs. Clinton. She was Secretary of State handling this case at the time. Between Mrs. Clinton and Jake Sullivan, one of her aides, and the Associated Press quotes, the gentleman, meaning Amiri, has apparently gone to his country's interest section because he is unhappy with how much time it has taken to facilitate his departure. This could lead to problematic news stories in the next 24 hours. The Iranian opposition, the National Council of Resistance of Iran, has a stunning statement out. They say Amiri's execution is a desperate attempt by the Supreme Leader Khamenei to intimidate and terrorize the regime's nuclear experts and scientists to prevent them from leaving the country after the nuclear deal. Engulfed in serious domestic and external crises and facing growing popular discontent and opposition at home, the regime has had to deal with unprecedented defections within its own ranks.
All right, that was Eric Shawn of Fox News, partially his report. I don't think any news story in the last few weeks has illustrated the potentially dangerous misdeeds, missteps of the Obama administration and, of course, Hillary's complicity as Secretary of State. Then the whole arrangement with Iran over the nuclear deal, and now this story over this nuclear scientist who we think was working with the Americans to reveal what the Iranians were actually doing. Michael Flynn is one of the nation's leading experts on the nation of Iran, and he, of course, is the co-author with this, with the General Flynn on the book, The Field of Fight. It is a world war, and it includes Iranian nuclear weapons. Michael, you have a theory about this Shamran Amiri, and I'd love for you to tell my audience what you think might have happened in this case.
Go back to various news stories about him. He goes back to Iran in 2010 from the United States, at which point the American government, in this case primarily, I should think, the intelligence community, CIA and the others, told everybody, Associated Press, Washington Post, New York Times, you name it, that Amiri had in fact been a CIA spy in Iran and had given us valuable information about the Iranian nuclear program. And when I read that, I said, oh, my God, that's an assassination attempt, because you put out information like that saying to the Iranians, go ahead, you're right, kill him, He was our spy. He spied for us. He betrayed you. Help yourself. And that's what they did in the course of time. But they only did it after he had spent 6 years in prison, and they finally got the ultimate confirmation of this in the Hillary Sullivan emails.
Yes, and actually, you know, in that, I think in that clip there was, I think Hillary was, she, I know there was a clip of her talking about him. He can go home when he wants to. He's here of his own volition. I mean, the signals actually revealing what he was doing and really removing any kind of protection from him were absolutely amazing. And so your theory is that they set him up to be killed. And yet, you know, in this strange world in which we live, he, we think, was here to help us. It is so bizarre, Michael, and I know you agree with that, but let's talk about something else that I think is certainly the academic understanding, the long understanding you have of communism and of Islamism. And you say that there was a marriage of that way back in the early mid part of the 20th century. Can you explain that so that we can understand?
Well, there's a literature on this. This is not new with me. It's been out there for quite a while, but there's been an alliance for quite a while between radical secular leftists and radical religious Muslims. And that's the alliance that we face today in this global war that General Flynn and I wrote about. It runs from Pyongyang to Caracas, and it includes radical secular regimes like Russia, North Korea, Venezuela, Cuba, and so forth, and radical Muslim groups and regimes like Iran, to an increasing degree Turkey, Al-Qaeda, ISIS, and so forth. And it's a global alliance. It is a big deal. And we have better developed a strategy to win that war.
The one piece of this I remember is that the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem was very close to the Nazis during World War II. But that doesn't, I still help us understand how that could be, Michael. Because you know that, like, the secularists now allegedly are so counter to the Islamic teaching, allegedly, on some of the basic moral principles. How in the world can they work together? Why is it they find common ground when you've got a radically religious group and a completely irreligious group? How do you explain that?
Well, they share many things. They share hatred of the West, above all of the United States and Israel. They have contempt for democracy. They think dictatorship is a much more stable, powerful, and effective system. And they want revenge because we won the Second World War and destroyed totalitarian fascism and Nazism. And the Muslims, Muslim anti-Semitism, Muslim racism, comes in large part from German racism. And was exported to that part of the world before and during World War II. And indeed, a surprising number of Nazis ended up in the Arab world after the war and deepened their understanding of it. And at the same time, people like the Ayatollah Khomeini in Iran worked very closely with the Iranian Communist Party, and he learned a lot about organization and totalitarian systems from the communists.
Remember the quaint days when George W. Bush used to talk about the evil axis, and I think axis had like three countries, North Korea, Iran, and I'm not sure what the third one was.
Iraq.
Okay. Oh, yeah, okay. All right. How could I forget that? All right, so the evil axis now has multiplied, and that group of countries, as you document in your book, are working together to undermine the United States. Can you explain that coalition of nefarious partners and what they are doing, you know, actual examples of what they're doing?
Well, just look at Syria. Who's defending the tyrant Assad in Syria? It's Iran and Russia together in an alliance. The whole Iranian nuclear program is Russian. It's all provided by the Russians. It's Russian nuclear plants. It's Russian nuclear physicists training the Iranians. Iranians go to Russia. to train in this stuff. The new anti-aircraft missile system in Iran is Russian. They're in cahoots. They're very intimate.
And then we have the issue of North Korea, Cuba, Venezuela, all of them partnering in various ways. Well, I'm left some out, too. Sharing nuclear weaponry secrets, you know, all these reports of them working together. It is extremely frightening and dangerous time. And yet our administration cooperates and reaches out, you know, puts the olive branch out to these various enemies of ours, except for North Korea, I guess. We're just throwing them bones, I suppose. We're not putting out the olive branch. That's a mystery too, isn't it, Michael?
Look, Obama comes from a generation, many of whom have been educated in American universities and American high schools, that teach that the United States is the guilty party for most of the world's problems. We are the cause, we have brought it about, and that the best thing you can do to bring about a more peaceful world is to get the United States out of these areas, to make peace with our former enemies, and to break the old alliances through which we worked to create this bad world as they see it. He believes that. He said that over and over again. So the deal with Cuba, so the deal with Iran, and his efforts to establish, to get the reset with Russia, which was Hillary's big task, with Putin, who's our enemy.
Russia has been one of the most fascinating situations to me, just to watch the thing evolve. I mean, it's the strangest. First you have, you know, the president almost like a puppy dog, tell Vladimir we'll have more flexibility if I get reelected, like he's his great uncle. He's saying that in what he thinks is the private conversation. And he sort of fawns over Putin when he sees him, and Hillary does the reset button, and then Putin comes back like a snake to bite him, you know, in the Ukraine, and really seems to have open hostility for Barack Obama. I find that interesting. I mean, I've always thought that the fascination for Putin was because of Obama's communist roots, and he certainly does have them, with Frank Marshall Davis, his own father, and on we could go, that romance of Russia. But the romance of Russia kind of came back to bite him, didn't it?
Sure did. It certainly did. He's very bad at geopolitics and foreign policy, I must say. Technically, he has a lot more information than some of the politicians out there, Trump, for example. But he's got very poor understanding of the way the world works, and right now our enemies have contempt for it.
You know, speaking of that, you mentioned something in this book that I haven't heard of. It's kind of under the category of this whole business of Islamophobia and people bending over backwards, like in race relations, to say things that aren't true, to flatter, to ignore. And the point is made by you guys that Muslims, many Muslims, resent the kind of flattery that takes them for idiots. That's interesting to me. Can you explain that?
Well, it's an integral part of their belief that the infidels are enemies. And so when some infidel stands up and says, we're fine with Islam, we don't have any hatred, and we're not going to brook any criticism of Islam in our countries and so on, the Muslims take this for a lie, for disinformation, an attempt to trick them. Because they know, in quotation marks, that we are hostile to them and that we are their enemies.
You know, it is interesting to me, on that the last time you and I spoke on the air, I think was at Islamic publication Dabiq 15, and they're like laying out, this is why we hate you. This is what it is about Christianity, that we, you know, Jesus wasn't, you know, we don't believe the cross. I mean, taking on the very doctrines of the faith in Christianity, but sort of an anger at, no, come on, we hate you. Really, we hate you, and this is why. And like at the I'm sure it is exasperating to them. They are looking for a fight, and they're getting this mealy-mouthed response. But Michael, some would argue that that's good. Rather than taking the fight to them, we're sort of appeasing them, and it's flummoxing them. Isn't that a good thing?
No, because it encourages other people to sign up because they think that the radicals are the winners. and they're going to win. We're not fighting back. We're not even defending ourselves. And so they want to be on the winning side. And so recruitment gets much easier. There was a big drop-off in recruitment for Al-Qaeda when we beat them in Iraq. And there were recruiting problems for Taliban in Afghanistan after we won battle after battle in Afghanistan. But now recruitment's going back up because they're doing better.
Well, and the problem with the kind of recruitment is that it's recruitment all over the world with people in their own home looking at the internet and going out and, you know, doing violence on their own without having to organize in an army. So, well, all right. Michael Ladeen and General Michael Flynn have written this new book called The Field of Fight, and they say we can win the global war against radical Islam and its allies. And they lay the reasons and the ways that we can do that out in this book. It is a bestseller right now, and so we highly recommend it. We'll put a link on our Facebook page. And Michael Ladeen, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for your valuable time this morning.
Thank you, Sandy. It's always a joy and a pleasure.
Okay, thank you, and talk to you soon. All right, well, Sandy Rios, in the morning on AFR Talk.